parshas of Vayakhel and Pishudei are typically underrepresented as the repetition of parshas Truma and Tetzaveh. Of course, that is very far from the truth, and never more so for us this year, who didn't discuss the Mishkan at all. And this is our first exposure through Vayakhel and Pishudei. And as we know, the parsha begins with Moshe assembling Bnei Yisrael to tell them about the Mishkan at great length. But before he does so, he prefaces with another topic, namely that of Shabbos. Vayakel Moshe, Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Aleph, Vayakel Moshe es kol hadas Bnei Yisrael vayomer aleihem, eila hadvarim asher tzivah Hashem laso, so some. And the Mishkan will yet follow, but immediately he discusses Shabbos. Sheishes yomim te'asem malocha, uvayom ha'shvi, ye'elechem kodesh Shabbos, Shabbos ha'nashem, etc. And Rashi comments, hikdim lahem, azhoras Shabbos, letzivui meleches ha'mishkan. It is quite true. In principle, in general, the discussion here is the Mishkan. But Moshe prefaces a mentioning of Shabbos before he talks about the Mishkan. Lomar, to communicate, she'eino doche es ha-Shabbos, that the Mishkan, as important as it is, does not override Shabbos. You cannot build the Mishkan on Shabbos. And therefore Rashi, pardon me, the Pasuk, mentions Shabbos first, as if to say, Shabbos comes first, which is very important for the Jewish people in terms of their schedule for building the Mishkan. Now, Mefarshim raised, I would say, two questions. It's a double-barreled question. But the truth is that this message, that the building of the Mishkan does not supersede the Shabbos, is already to be found in the Torah. Actually, in last week's Parsha. For Parsha's Kisisa, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is talking to Moshe about the Mishkan, at that point he follows and says, Aches Shabsosai Tishmoru, and Rashi comments, as much as you're building the Mishkan, but not on Shabbos. So build the Mishkan, but also keep Shabbos. Because don't build the Mishkan on Shabbos. And therefore, the first part of the question is, why are we being told something that we were told last week in Parshas Kisisa? We found out that the building of the Mishkan doesn't supersede Shabbos. Why do we need to be told again in Parshas Vayakhel? That question can be weathered, because we need to remember that the contents of Kisisa were told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe. Vayakhel is Moshe communicating to Bnei Yisrael. So as surely as the Mishkan itself was first told to Moshe and then Moshe to Yisrael, so far, we don't have an acute problem. But the follow-up to the question is, this message hasn't been repeated. It's been reordered in that the first time round in Parshas Kisisa, the way that the message was communicated that the building of the Mishkan doesn't override Shabbos was by describing the Mishkan, and then Shabbos, as if to say, build the Mishkan, but not on Shabbos. So the Mishkan came first, Shabbos came second, and the point is that Shabbos, the Mishkan stopped on Shabbos. In Vayakhel, we may borrow a phrase from recent days, v'nafochu, first came Shabbos, and then the Mishkan was described. Now the message, of course, is the same, but the medium is not the same. V'halodavarhu, it's meant to be a repetition, no more, no less. But it's actually undergone a reversal of sorts. Now there's a conservation of energy. The message is the same, but still, hadavar omer darsheni. And this is a question that many mefarshim raise. And I came across a while back a fascinating response to this question in the Tshuvas of the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg, in Chelek Ches Simen Tesvav. And he begins by prefacing with a fascinating statement in the Gemara, Maseches Shabbos Daf Kuf Yud Ches. The Gemara is talking about the importance of Shabbos and has many major statements to make in that regard. And amongst them, says the Gemara, if a person keeps Shabbos, Kalashoma Shabbos, Afilu Oved Avodazara Kedor Enosh, even if this was the person who had been Oved Avodazara, like Enosh, Mochlin though, he can receive Kapara. It will be forgiven. And the source is unbelievable. It's a pasuk in Yeshaya. The Haftarah for Tanis Tzibur, we may be familiar with it. Ashrei Enosh Yasezos. Uven Adam Machzik Ba, Shomer Shabbos Mechalalo. We would look at the words Ashrei Enosh Yasezos. Happy is the person who does this. Says the Gemara, Enosh is not the typical generic phraseology for a person. It would be Ashrei Ish or Ashrei Adam or Ashrei Hagever. Ashrei Enosh means even like Enosh, Enosh the person, because the concept of Avodah Zarah began in the days of Enosh, as the Rambam states in Hilchos Avodah Zarah. And therefore, happy is even someone like Enosh. Shomer Shabbos Mechalalo, says the Gemara, Machullo, he has been forgiven. Now, hopefully, this is not halacha lemaisa for any of us, but we do need to understand it. The Torah quotes it as his introduction to Hilchos Shabbos. If a person keeps Shabbos correctly, even if he served Avodah Zarah like Enosh, Mochelin lo. And the Turei Zav, Rabbi David Halevi, in his commentary, the Shulchan Aruch, is very intrigued by this statement. And he, in classic rabbinic style, says, Mimonav Shach. However you configure it, I have a problem. We have a concept called tshuva. Are we to understand, are we to presume that this person did tshuva as well as keeping Shabbos, or just kept Shabbos? Says the Taz, if he didn't do tshuva for Avodah Zarah, Shabbos is not going to help him. I think we'll all agree. Ella, what will we conclude? That he did do tshuva. Well, if he did tshuva, then why does he need to do anything else? The tshuva conquers all. So what room is there for this key factor of keeping Shabbos per se? Says the Taz, it's clear that we're talking about a person, he must have done tshuva. But he's not out of the woods. And the reason why is because, as we know, the Talmud tells us in the end of Maseches Yuma that there is a certain hierarchy of severity of sins, and there are certain averos which are averos chamuros, avodah zarah certainly amongst them, for which tshuva does not do the entire job. There are certain things that one needs Yom Kippur, and there are certain things, lo aleinu, but the Gemara says a person needs to go through even yisurim, difficulties of sorts, in order to fully expiate, in order to fully achieve kapara. Says the Taz, what the Gemara is saying when it tells us that if a person keeps Shabbos, he can get mechila, even for Avodah Zarah, we are clearly talking about a person who has done tshuva. That is non-negotiable. But for something like Avodah Zarah, tshuva shouldn't be enough. He should have to undergo more difficulties. It's of the Averos Chamuros. And to that end, the Gemara says, no, if he keeps Shabbos, tshuva together with Shabbos being kept properly will be enough. Because the power of Shabbos, with the message of Shabbos, which is, of course, the absolute antithesis and antidote to Avodah Zarah, which is straying from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Shabbos is reaffirming the absolute focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu as creator and the one who runs the world, that's the power of Shabbos to give this person mechila, tshuva plus Shabbos. What's interesting is the Gemara made a specific point of singling out an individual called Enosh. It's true, Avodah Zarah started with Enosh, but is there anything, if one could ask, is there anything unique or characteristic about the Avodah Zarah of Enosh? Well, actually, the Chofetz Chaim, in one of his Sfarim, Shem Olam, says yes. For the Rambam tells us that the beginnings of Avodah Zarah, not that they could be condoned and they're never correct, they are the nth degree removed from correct, but it began with a mistake. People had a sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so lofty, and he has set up a system of the world. Presumably, the presumption was that he wishes obeisance to be given also to those forces. And thus, with the best of intentions, was Avodah Zarah born. Within the course of time, says the Rambam, ignorance exists everywhere, and people forgot the original ideology, and it deteriorated into a complete detached allegiance to these forces for themselves, and perhaps even to the objects that were meant to represent them. And that's Avodah Zarah, the pagan Avodah Zarah, as it became known. But originally, Bimei Enosh, says Rambam, Ta'u b'nei Adam Ta'us Gadola, that was their mistake. And therefore, the Chofetz Chaim suggests that it could be when the Gemara says that if a person served Avodah Zarah like Enosh, what that means is he never lost focus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the top of the picture. He just made a terrible mistake to attach any allegiance to anything in between. But such a person can be redeemed through tshuva and through Shabbos. Says Rav Waldenberg, Acharei Hadvarim Ha'ele, if there is ever an episode that one could say had an affinity with the generation of Enosh, was the Chet HaEgel. Because the Chet HaEgel, there is no question that however it ended up, and opinions are divided as to how it ended up. Was it full-blown Avodah Zarah? Was it on the way? But it certainly did not start that way. And more specifically, nowhere do we find that the Jewish people were looking to stray from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If they were, the one person that they approached would be the person they would most wish to avoid, namely Aaron. There's no way that they could enlist Aaron in Avodah Zarah per se. They wanted Aaron to create another means for them to communicate with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or for him to communicate with them. That's how it began. They wanted to enlist Aaron's help. If it was full-blown Avodah Zarah, they would have gone to some alleyway somewhere far from where Aaron was. Of course, it deteriorated. From day one to day two, it spiraled downwards. Quite true. But the mistake of the Chet HaEgel was analogous to the Chet of Dor Enosh, whereby they thought that it was correct to set up something in the middle as an intermediary. And therefore, if Shabbos is part of, it completes the kapara for Avodah Zarah of the Dor Enosh category, so the Waldenberg, we can understand that when Moshe Rabbeinu gathers Bnei Yisrael together, and these are his first words to them after Yom Kippur, and it's about rehabilitation, and it's about getting themselves back together post the Egel, and receiving full forgiveness post the Egel, Shabbos exists now in two capacities. Not only within the context of the Mishkan, to know that the Mishkan will not override Shabbos. Shabbos is part of the remedy, because they themselves need Shabbos in order to secure the kapara for the Chet HaEgel, and therefore Shabbos comes first, because within the remedial capacity they need to hear about Shabbos as soon as possible. Ashrei Enosh Yaaseh Zos. So this is a very interesting approach of Rav Waldenberg. It's within the course, it's the beginning of essentially a lengthy treatise on Pikuach Nefesh and Shabbos, which is the one of his fields of expertise, but this is a nugget that relates to Parshas Vayakel. Now, with regards to Shabbos, as we know, the Melachos, as a rule, are derived from the Mishkan, actually. Not only can one not build a Mishkan on Shabbos, but we end up finding out what you can't do on Shabbos from the way that the Mishkan was done. Now, by definition, it's interesting to note that from within the 39 Melachos, all of which are learnt generally from Shabbos, one of them is learnt specifically from Parshas Vayakel. It is not left as an observation of how they built the Mishkan, and that thus we derive not to do that on Shabbos. There is a specific pasuk to give us the message with regards to this malacha, and that is the malacha of carrying, transporting, transferring from Rosh Hashanah Yochid to Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, from private to public domain, and vice versa. And as we know, as a malacha, it's rather different in nature. The consequences are just as dire. A person is liable for whatever for carrying as he is for any of the other malachas, but certainly it has a different dynamic on the face of it, whereby a person is changing location, but not necessarily changing the state of the matter. Ultimately, the chiddush of the malacha of carrying is that changing the location is considered to be a changing of the state of the matter. Change its setting is considered a qualitative change for the thing itself. But where does it come from? Well, says the Talmud in Masechet Shabbos, Daf Tzadik Vav Amud Beis, if you take a look in Vayakel, Perek Lamed Vav, Pasuk Vav. Vayitzav Moshe, Moshe sends out a directive, Vayaviru Kol Bamachane Leimor, the message went through the Machane, Ish V'isha Al Yasu Od Melacha L'Trumas HaKodesh. Let people do no more Melacha, Vayikalei Ha'am Mehavi, and people stop bringing things. Says the Gemara, you see from here that Moshe said, no more malacha, and the very next words are, and people stop bringing things, that for them to bring something to Moshe itself constitutes a malacha, because they are in their private residences, and to go through Machane Leviya, as the Gemara explains and works it out, that's Rishus HaRabim, and from here we learn that to carry from the private to the public domain, or vice versa, on Shabbos, is a malacha. Now, what's interesting is, and many Mefarshim point this out, if we take a look at the context of Pasuk Vav, which will be found in Pasuk Dalet and Hey, we seem to get a somewhat different picture. Namely, why are they told not to bring anything, not to bring anything more? Well, because it's a malacha, and you can't do malacha on Shabbos. That's the implication. If it wasn't Shabbos, it wouldn't be a problem. They can bring as much as they want. Well, let's read Pasuk Dalet and Hey. Vayavo kol hachachamim ha'osim eis kol melechas hakodesh. Ish ish mimelachto ashehema osim. So all of the artisans and all of those that were in charge of the various areas of malacha, they came to Moshe. Vayamu Moshe leimor, marbim ha'am lavi. People are bringing, they brought enough, too much even. Midei havodah l'mlacha, asher tzivah Hashem la'asos, I said, they're bringing more than we need. What happens next? So Moshe says, they don't bring any more. And they didn't. The pashtus, contextually, of the pasuk of Moshe saying, don't bring any more, and people stop bringing, is because they had enough. Now, we understand each other. If there's a malacha on Shabbos at stake, you can't do it even if they don't have enough. You have to wait till Sunday. So the background to them not bringing, which seems to be a logistical issue, they had enough. So they don't need any more, not on Shabbos, and not on Monday, and not on Wednesday. But when the Pasuk says that they stop bringing, we learn from here that you can't carry on Shabbos. How does that come out from the flow of the psukim? It is possible, by the way, that the Gemara does not mean to darshan it contextually. And that's really a very important facet to be aware of. Medrash Halacha, that it is extra contextual. That's important. As surely as Drush has a different way of looking at things, it also is capable of isolating things from their context in order to teach us halachas. Is that what has happened here? Well, some will say yes. But Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin says no. Our question was, again to be clear, we derive from this pasuk that you can't carry on Shabbos, it's a malacha, but the background seems to be that they had enough, and that's why they said not to bring any more. But that doesn't sound like it's a malacha. Says the Maril Diskin, it's all true. They're both right. It is true that the background to not bringing is the fact that they have enough. And it is also true that we derive from here that you cannot carry on Shabbos. Haketzad. How can it be? Says the Maral Diskin. Let's take a look at what is happening here and when it is happening. The parsha begins, Vayakhel Moshe, he gathers everyone together. When did he do that? Well, Rashi tells us, L'machros Yom Kippurim, the day after Yom Kippur, that is to say, the 11th of Tishrei. And Moshe then tells them, the Bnei Yisrael, to donate, give generously to the Mishkan, which they do. And the Pasuk says, V'heim eviu od nedova baboker baboker. Now, those words, baboker baboker, need to be understood. What does it mean? In the morning, in the morning. Sometimes the Gemara says, baboker baboker means early in the morning. Right? The repetition means to emphasize the morningness. But the Medrash says that Baboker, Baboker refers to two successive mornings. If they were gathered together on the 11th, when it says they brought materials Baboker, Baboker, that means they brought on the morning, the following morning of the 12th, and the morning after that of the 13th. And then, people began to take stock. On the 14th, they come to Moshe, and they say, we have enough. That message is timely, because the next day is the 15th of Tishrei, and the 15th of Tishrei is the first day of Sukkot, and the first day of Sukkot is Yom Tov. And on Yom Tov, you can't do Malacha. Now, having said that, of course, as we know, sometimes you can do Malacha on Yom Tov. Not in principle, what you can't do on Shabbos, you can't do on Yom Tov. But there are certain things that you can do on Yom Tov. First and foremost, of course, we're mindful of the pasuk in Parshas Bo, Ach asher yachel ochal nefesh hu levado yaseh lachem, what's called ochal nefesh, malachas that relate to food. However, and we all know this from our Yom Tov experience, it's very interesting to know where it comes from, one is allowed to do those malachas not only for food, but also for any other legitimate purpose. In the famous words of the Gemara from Maseches Beitza, Daf Yud Beis, Mitoch Shehutra Malacha Letzoruch Ochal Nefesh, once the Torah was matir, these malachas for Ochal Nefesh, Hutra Shelo Letzoruch Ochal Nefesh. They're also mutter, even not for the sake of Ochal Nefesh. Okay, and that is why, even in a place, if you know of such a place anymore where there is no Eruv, one nonetheless on Yom Tov, one can carry a machzor to shul, and one can carry their keys to shul. Those aren't food. One is, and carrying is a malacha, but it's a legitimate need. However, there is a caveat, most important, that many Rishonim point out. Even as the dispensation has been given and extends beyond Ochal Nefesh, it doesn't have to be for the sake of Ochal Nefesh, but it's got to be for the sake of something. It's got to be for some legitimate purpose. It can't be for no purpose at all. That remains absolutely osur. And therefore, if we come now to ask the question, would it be acceptable for the Jewish people to bring things for the Mishkan tomorrow? Tomorrow being Yom Tov, first day of Sukkot. The answer to that, of course, will be, is it necessary? Does the Mishkan still need it? If the answer is yes, then there is room to say that they can actually bring it on Yom Tov because it's mitoch shehutru letzoruch ochal nefesh, as long as it's for some legitimate need, they could carry even on Yom Tov. And that is why the people came to Moshe and they said, we have enough. Ah, once we have enough, so then if you would carry tomorrow on Yom Tov, it would be an Aveira, because you'd be doing a malacha of carrying on Yom Tov for no reason, because the Mishkan doesn't need it, and it has no purpose. It's Shalom Letzorech Klal, and that would be an Aveira of carrying on Yom Tov. And therefore, says the Maral Diskin, you see how the two dovetail, how the context of the fact that they had enough actually translates into the malacha, because if you have enough on Yom Tov, it makes a difference. Of course, what makes a difference on Yom Tov makes no difference on Shabbos. And therefore, if it wasn't necessary on Yom Tov, that would make it a malacha for Shabbos, even if it would be necessary. Malacha is malacha. And that is how the Gemara derives that carrying the malacha from this pasuk. Now, those are the words of the Maral Diskin, and that is really a stunning comment, if we may say so. There is perhaps room to make one observation, and that is, the Jewish month is comprised of 29 and a half and a bit days. And because that's true, that is why, although Rosh Chodesh can be either 30 days or 31 days, that is to say the average month can either be 29 or 30 days, they will tend on average to switch off, one male, one choser. And because that's true, all things being equal, if you are at a certain point in the year, you should be able to calculate or to predict with reasonable accuracy when a certain date, what day of the week it will fall. And in fact, so we do. There is a famous siman acronym with regards to Pesach, the Atbash system. The Atbash basically takes the first letter of the Aleph Beis and the last, second and second to last, third and third to last, and it goes through each of the days of Pesach, Aleph Beis, Gimel, Dalet, and working backwards, Taf, Shin, Resh, Kuf, it tells you what this very same day that Aleph Beis, Gimel, Dalet of Pesach fell, you now know on the corresponding day, Taf, Shin, Resh, and Kuf of the following year will be. What are Taf, Shin, Resh, and Kuf? Well, Taf, if we start with Aleph, Aleph, Taf, the first day of Pesach happens to be always the same day of the week that Tisha B'Av will fall. Beis, second, takes you second from the end. Beis is Shin. The second day of Pesach will always be the same day of the week as Shavuos. And what about Resh, Gimel Resh? The third day of Pesach will always be the day of Rosh Hashanah in the next year. That is tried and tested. The only thing is, however, this is true when the Luach is fixed for us. At a time when the Rosh Chodesh is al pi hariya, is through the testimony from Adim, so anything can happen, depending on the, we assume that it would happen the same way, but it doesn't have to happen the same way. And the reason why I mention all of this is as follows. The Talmud tells us in Masechet Shabbos in the 9th Perek, and so does the Michilta in Parshas B'Shalach, and as we know, when the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, they left Mitzrayim on a Thursday. Pesach of Yetzias Mitzrayim was Thursday. Pesach Yetzias Mitzrayim is Thursday. That means that the third day of Pesach that year was a Shabbos. And if the third day of Pesach that year was a Shabbos, Gimel Reish means the following Rosh Hashanah will also fall on Shabbos. And if Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, which is the first of Tishrei, then the first of Sukkot, which is exactly 2 weeks later, will also fall on a Shabbos. Which means that year, the first day of Sukkot, in addition to being Yom Tov, was also Shabbos. And whereas it makes a difference whether you need to do a certain malacha when it's Yom Tov, but when Yom Tov falls on Shabbos, it doesn't make a difference anymore. And thus, we observe that presumably Rabbi Shua Leib Diskin, in his explanation, will understand that it did not follow the intuitive pattern, although many say that it did. What the expected, the third day of Pesach will be Rosh Hashanah the next year, actually was not the case, because if it was Shabbos, then once again the question returns, you can't do it even if you don't need it. Rather, it would have been some other day of the week, Friday or Sunday, depending, in which case Myril Diskin is back. So that's food for thought. Now, if we move to the beginning of Pekudei, we will yet get further insight into the building of the Mishkan, because whereas we over simplistically refer to Vayakhel as a repeat of Parshas Truma, whatever they were told to do in Truma, they did in Parshas Vayakhel. Well, it's largely the case, but that's all the more reason to pay very close attention to the things that are not the same. And one of the glaring differences is the order in which the Mishkan was built. If we could divide the Mishkan generally into the building of the Mishkan and the Kalim inside the Mishkan, there seems to be, once again, a reversal in this very matter. For the beginning of Parshas Truma, the first half of the Parsha deals with the Kalim. No sooner has the Parsha begun, Vasu Aron, Vasisa Menorah, Vasisa Shulchan, and then the second half of the Parsha deals with the Krushim, the beams, and the Yerios, and the body of the Mishkan itself. As we will read in Parshas Vayakhel, when Bezalel made it, he didn't make it that way. First he made the body of the Mishkan, and then he manufactured the Kalim, and that's the order as it's described in Vayakhel. And this reversal is noted by Chazal in the Talmud in Maseches Brachos and Daf Nun Hei, and referred to by Rashi himself in the beginning of Parshas Pekudei. Because in the second pasuk of the parsha, Perek Lamed Ches, pasuk Kaf Beis, the pasuk says, "Uvetzalel ben Uri ben Hur lematei Yehuda asa es kol asher tziva Hashem es Moshe." Bezalel did everything that Hashem told Moshe, and Rashi makes a classic observation: "Asher tziva oso Moshe ein ksiv." The pasuk doesn't say that Bezalel did everything that Moshe told him to do. It says he did everything Hashem told Moshe to do. Elakola shetziva Hashem es Moshe. Afilu dvorim shelo omar lo rabo. Even things that Moshe didn't tell him to do. Hiskima dato lemashenem ala Moshe b'sinai. Bezalel intuited the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted it to be, even though Moshe actually told him a different order. What does this mean? Ki Moshe tziva lebezalel la'asos tchila kelim v'chakach mishkan. Moshe actually told Bezalel to make the kelim first. Now, what is about to happen is itself unbelievable, because Bezalel responds and questions. Amar lo Bezalel, and listen to what he says. Min ha'olam la'asos tchila bayis. Generally speaking, people make a house first, v'achakach meisim kelim betocho, and then they put the furniture inside. And really what Bezalel means to say is, so why are you telling me first to make the appurtenances and then to make the Mishkan? And Rashi actually is mekatzer here. He quotes in a very abridged form, but the Gemara says in much more detailed language, Bezalel says, maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually told you differently. Maybe first to make the Mishkan and then the Kelim. Could it be? I'm just asking. And what type of svara is that? Minog minhogo shel olam. This is hardly a normal house. You know, grounds for akasha, based on the way that the average person will build a house, that seems to be the least relevant factor here. And that's what Bezalel says. And Moshe says, you're right. Kach shamati mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Amar Moshe Bezalel kel hayisa. Hence the name Bezalel. Bezalel means in the shade of God. That means, says Moshe, you must have been in the shade. Sounds like you must have been in the wings. You must have been somewhere there in the shadows, because really, apparently, you overheard it. And that's why the pasuk says that Bezalel did what Hashem told Moshe, not what Moshe told him. This entire exchange is off the charts. Very difficult to understand for a number of reasons. Firstly, of course, the essential question, does it make a difference, and what difference does it make? Whether or not one makes the Kelim first and then the Mishkan, or vice versa. And moreover, we see clearly from the Gemara that Moshe was told ultimately to tell Bezalel to make the Mishkan first, and he reversed it. And then Bezalel counter-reversed it. Why would Moshe reverse it if he's told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell him to make the Mishkan first? So why would he try and reverse it? And of course, Bezalel's rather unimpressive sounding argument, with which he is prepared to face Moshe Rabbeinu and question what he said, minhogo shel olam, it's got to represent something else. Those are the sort of questions that get a person sent to the back of the class. In the Sefer Ein Yaakov, which is of course the classic collection of Mefarshim on the Agodas, he quotes from a Sefer called Gaon Yaakov. I'm not sure who wrote it, but it's a very beautiful perish. To understand, to get a glimpse of understanding into what's happening with between Moshe and Bezalel, and he's called Bezalel, he's in the shade. As we know, everything in the world, every living thing in the world, contains within it two component parts. It has its physical properties, and then it has its spiritual life force, it has its spiritual essence. Generally speaking, we would say that the human tendency is to give primacy, or at the very least to relate more directly to the physical aspect of things. For example, a human being consists of a guf and a neshama. They have a physical and a spiritual aspect to them. You would generally visually identify them first physically before you get to know them and then relate to their spiritual side. And the reason why, of course, is because we live in a physical world. And therefore, from within that setting, the default mode of connection will be within those terms. And from there, one develops a spiritual insight. This is true, of course, for everyone except for Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu, who's by this stage out of this world, he's been on high for 40 days, lechem lo achal, mayim lo shasam. There's going to be a marked difference in the way that he looks at things. When he sees something, he will see it's, he is in the spiritual realm. And he will see, identify first and foremost with the spiritual aspect, and the physical aspect will be secondary. Of course, this will have major implications when we talk about the Mishkan. The entire Mishkan is holy, but certainly the inner content of the Mishkan are the Kelim. That's where the Avoda takes place. They are the Ruchnius to the physical setting of the body of the Mishkan. And therefore, it becomes a question of impulse, of instinct. Moshe's instinct is to give primacy to the Kelim. And even though one could say it's not practical, because where would you put the Kelim? Which actually is the question that Bezalel asked. Where am I going to put the Kelim? But those are practical concerns. They can't sway the essential primacy that needs to be given to the Kelim. And even as, in a sense, therefore, even as Moshe is told by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, go tell Bezalel to make the Mishkan first and then the Kelim, but Moshe sees that as a concession to Bezalel. But Moshe is looking to do things on the highest level possible. And this is exactly the point where Bezalel counters with a very earthy response. Minhago shel olam is not that way. What does he mean by that? What he means to say is, you reversed because you're not minhago shel olam. You don't live in this world, almost. When you think Mishkan, you think Kelim. You see through the walls. But the rest of us aren't like you. And moreover, the way the Gemara says it, Bezalel says to him, Kelim she'ani osa laheicha nachnisim, the Kelim that I make, where will I put them? And what does he mean to do by stressing Kelim she'ani osa, the Kelim that I make? What he means to say is, there must be a reason why I'm making the Kelim and not you, because the Kelim, because the Mishkan is for the Jewish people. It has to be equivalent to their level, of course, to raise them up, but it has to be consonant with the way that they view things. Otherwise, they have no traction. They have no cohesion with what's happening in the Mishkan. And that is exactly why I, who am a lesser level than you are, was told to make the Mishkan and not you. Because if you make the Mishkan, no one will know how to relate to it. Kelim Shani Yosef, and if I'm going to make the Kelim, it's because I'm a more earth person than you are. So then I have to factor in Minhago Shel Olam, because that's the type of people everybody else is. And in the end, Moshe conceded. But the way that he refers to it is he calls Bezalel Betzel Kael. You're in the shade of God, which is a good place to be. But it's not like Moshe. Because Moshe wasn't in the shade. The shade represents something physical that intersperses between the light and the recipient. If you're in the shade, there's something in between. For everyone in the world, there's something in between. It's the physical world. I mean, they've got to work with it. Moshe was the only one who wasn't in the shade. I mean, he was directly in the light, and he saw things in that light. But for those who are Betzel Kael, who are in the shade, that characterizes the way that they need to go about things realistically in order to develop spiritually in a way that is consonant with the way that they view things. So this is a very interesting insight into that exchange between Moshe and Bezalel, upon which everyone has what to say. Now, part of the mechila for the egel, which is really what Vayakel and Pekudei are all about, are new luchos. And for many, they are a key part of the kapara, so much so that when the Gemara says in Maseches Tanis that one of the happiest days of the year was Yom Kippur, Tu B'Av, everybody knows. And Yom Kippur, and you're not really Jewish until you understand that Yom Kippur is the happiest day of the year. Why? What's so happy about it? Well, the Gemara explains. Two things happened. Number one, Yom Shenitnu Bo Luchos Shniim. That was the day that the second set of luchos were given. And Yom Shenitnu Bo Slicha U'Mechila. That was the day that forgiveness was given. That means that the Gemara almost puts them together. These were the two fantastic developments which make Yom Kippur the happiest day of the year. Kapara was received by the Bnei Yisrael, and a new set of luchos. We should note, actually, that there is a key difference between the second set of luchos and the first. Not only in that, who was it that got the luchos ready? Was it Moshe or HaKadosh Baruch Hu? But there is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Peah, Perek Beis, which comments on the pasuk in Parshas Ekev. And there the pasuk says, "Va'aleihem kechol hadvarim asher dibur Hashem." On the luchos, kechol hadvarim asher dibur Hashem. What does that mean? Well, it sounds like it means that the Aseres Hadibros, says the Yerushalmi, "Aleihem va'aleihem." It says, instead of kol hadvarim, it says kechol hadvarim. Mikra, Mishnah, Gemara, va'agoda. The Yerushalmi says, kechol hadvarim means that in addition to the Aseres Hadibros, which were written word for word, embedded and encrypted in the original set of luchos, was everything. As if to say, what Mikra, Mishnah, Halachas, Va'agoda sounds like it means that the division that of which we are aware of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh doesn't seem to have been so pronounced at that time. Because if you had access to it, everything was written in exactly the same place. Mikra, Mishnah, Halacha, Va'agoda. That said, says the Beis Halevi in the final of his drushas, Drush Yud Ches, that was only ever said about the first set of luchos, and it's only true for the first set of luchos. The second set of luchos, there was no Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebal Peh was already Baal Peh. And therefore there is a difference in terms of what was written on the luchos between the first and the second. Now, says the Beis Halevi, you may have a question. It's from Parshas Kisisa, which we read 2 days ago. And again, the laning for Tanis Tzibur, because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe to get luchos ready, psal lecha shnei luchos avonim karishonim, and then Hashem says, and I will write on them, v'chosavti al luchos es hadvarim asher hayu al luchos harishonim. I will write what was written on the first luchos, I will write on the second luchos, and it sounds like there wasn't anything missing. But here I am, says the Beis Halevi, it's clear to me that there was a great deal missing. So how can it be? HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, what was written on the first, he'll write on the second. However, says Beis Halevi, there's a very well-known medrash which says that when Moshe saw the eagle, so from the luchos that he was holding, letters began to fly up. Ra haksav pareach. He saw the letters were evaporating. And at that point, the luchos, he was unable to hold them. And so he dropped them. It's a very well-known medrash. There's just one problem. The pasuk doesn't say that he dropped them. The pasuk says he smashed them. Va'ashabrein le'enecha. If he smashed them, that means he was capable of holding them, but chose to smash them anyway. How can the medrash say that they were too heavy to hold? Which is a good shaila. Says the Beis Halevi, when Moshe saw the eagle, and we came face to face with the eagle, ksav began to fly off the luchos. Which ksav? All ksav? No. Originally, Torah Shebal Peh was written into the luchos, and that evaporated as Moshe was confronted with the eagle. He was left with Torah Shebichtav only. Now, at that point, there was no Torah Shebal Peh. Everything was written down and half of it disappeared. Says the Beis Halevi, what happens if the Jewish people receive only Torah Shebichtav without Torah Shebal Peh? There's nothing. We don't know how to do even one mitzvah. The luchos with that ksav evaporated are impossible for Moshe to hold. And he chose to smash them rather than to give them to Bnei Yisrael without Torah Shebal Peh. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, make new luchos, and I will write on the luchos that which was written, right? Bechosavti al luchos es advarim asher ayu al luchos harishonim asher shibarta. On the first luchos that you broke. Now, as redundancies would go, this one seems to be rather painful. I think we all know which luchos we're talking about. Do they need to be further described as the luchos that Moshe broke? There were no other luchos. And that's why the Gemara darshans the words asher shibarta, because we don't need them to identify what luchos. Says the Beis Halevi, the words asher shibarta means Hashem says, I'm going to write on the second luchos everything that was written on the first luchos, asher shibarta, that you broke. Meaning, when you broke them. When you broke them, only Torah Shebichtav was written. And it's the only thing that's going to be written on the second ones. The question, of course, is, what about Torah Shebapeh? And that we have to see. And why is there this difference between the first set of luchos and the second? We find the Jewish people, who were called holy people, if we are medaktik, we watch carefully, we will see that there is a shift in nuance as to how the Jewish people are referred to, how they are, how they're meant to be. In Parshas Mishpatim, the pasuk says, "Va'anshe kodesh tiyuni." So the charge of the Jewish people is anshe kodesh. Okay. In Parshas Re'eh, again within the context of kosher and non-kosher, the pasuk says, "Ki am kodesh ata Hashem Elokecha." Now the two words kodesh and kodosh are very similar, but they're not the same. What is the difference between the Jewish people being referred to as Anshe Kodesh or as Am Kodesh? Says Meshech Chochma in Parshas Re'eh. The difference is actually spelled out in a Rashi in Maseches Kiddushin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Beis. For the word Kodesh is an entity. It's a noun. It's holiness. It's a concept. Anything that's Kodesh is something of Kodesh. Shekel HaKodesh. Anshe Kodesh refers to people who are associated with Kedusha, people of holiness. Kodosh, on the other hand, is an adjective. It describes a person who is holy. And therefore, the difference between Anshe Kodesh and Am Kodosh is the difference between people who are of holiness, associated with holiness, and people who are themselves holy. This is yet rather abstract. Does it make a difference whether something is Kodesh or Kodosh? Says Meshech Chochma, it does. With respect to the concept of Me'ilah, Me'ilah, to familiarize ourselves, refamiliarize, is if a person takes something that's sanctified and uses it for profane purposes, that's Me'ilah. He takes something that belongs to the Beis HaMikdash and uses it for his personal use, for profane use, mundane use. So that's called Me'ilah, and that is a sin. But now the question is, what happens to that article? Is it still holy? Or once he used it for a mundane use, has the article become mundane itself? Has it entered the realms that we would call chulin, the mundane? And the answer to this happens to be that it depends. If the item itself is holy, like, for example, an animal for a korban itself, the item itself is holy, it will never lose its kedusha, even as me'ilah has been performed on it. It's an aveira, one needs to make restitution, but the item itself remains kodesh. It's intrinsic and will never go away. But there's a type of kedusha where something is kodesh, it belongs to the Beis HaMikdash because it's associated with kedusha. It's not a korban, it could be money. Money used to buy something holy. So it's associated with Kedusha. It actually has monetary holiness. Kedusha Stomim, what's called. If a person would use that money for a profane purpose, it's no longer Kodesh. And thus you see, says Meshech Chochma, the difference between whether something is intrinsically holy or associated with holy will be found in whether it can weather the profanation of Me'ilah. How does this relate to us? Says Meshech Chochma, the Jewish people can also undergo Me'ilah. If the concept of Me'ilah is taking something that should be holy and should be for holy purposes and using it for misappropriating it and using it for profane purposes, so there is no greater Me'ilah than the very first sin nationally of the Jewish people, which is the Egel Hazav, whereby they took their allegiance and they took their money and they took everything and they directed it towards the Egel and not towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And now the question is, so what's left? having let themselves be available to use their assets and resources for chulin, are they kodesh anymore? And we find HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'll destroy them and I'll start again from Moshe. Apparently, their kedusha was not non-negotiable. Of course, Moshe davens that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should never do that. And his tefillahs are accepted. And that's when the eternal bond is forged. But in order to vouchsafe, and in a sense one could say, to make the status of the Jewish people me'ila-proof, that it can never be destroyed or abrogated via a sin which is the equivalent of me'ila, so they were actually raised, they were elevated from merely being, quote-unquote, merely being associated with Kedusha to intrinsic Kedusha. And that, of course, is the metric of Kodesh versus Kodesh. Kodesh, we said, means associated with Kedusha. Something associated with the Kedusha can become disassociated. But something that's Kodesh itself will always be Kodesh. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, note that in Parshas Mishpatim, when we're told, we're referred to as Anshei Kodesh, it's before the Chet HaEgel. Before the Chet HaEgel, if you've made no mistakes, so you can be Anshei Kodesh and stay there by not making mistakes. After the Egel, Anshei Kodesh can't survive. And therefore, the Jewish people from that point on will be referred to as Am Kodesh, as we find in the later Pasuk. The question that remains, however, is, how does this happen? It seems an important idea, crucial for the Jewish people to be elevated, to become intrinsically bound up with Kedusha, that they themselves are Kodosh, in order to vouchsafe their connection that can never be broken. But what exactly was the medium that established this? Well, as we go back to the Beis Halevi, he will discuss for us that if we take the moshel of a Sefer Torah, so there is the Sefer Torah itself, and there are its appurtenances. The Sefer Torah is the ink and the parchment. That is the Etzem HaKedusha. That is the holy article itself. Everything else are accessories for it. The covering of the Sefer Torah, the Aron HaKodesh, all of those things are accessories to the Kodesh. Now, initially, as everything is written on the Luchos, the Sefer is there outside of the Jewish people. They're the stones, or the Sefer Torah, or whatever, and everything is written. Now the Jewish people, as they make their connection with Torah, they do make their connection, but they are accessories to the Sefer. They are Tashmishei Kedusha. They are associated with the Kedusha that resides within the Luchos or the Sefer Torah. That's what happens when part of the Torah gets lifted off of the Luchos. Because it is no longer to be found or imprinted anywhere. So where will it be imprinted? It used to be written on stones. And now where is it written? Well, says the Pasuk in Mishlei, Kosveim Aluach Libecha. The Jewish people become the repository for Torah. It has been sublimated into information now. It won't be written anywhere. The repository of this Torah information are the Jewish people, and they now assume the status of a Sefer Torah. If the words are written on the Luchos or on the Klaf becomes a Sefer. And if they're lifted off the Klaf, they're no longer to be found there, and imprinted in the psyche and the consciousness and the intellect of the Jewish people, then the Jewish people become the Sefer. And they go from being associated with Kedusha to Etzem HaKedusha. They go from being Kodesh to Kodosh. They go from Kedusha Stomim to Kedusha Saguf. And that is how a repeat of the disaster of the Egel can never happen again. Because the Jewish people are already embedded too much within holiness to potentially lose that even through another Avera. We mentioned at the beginning of our remarks this evening something curious about the beginning of Vayakhel. The Jewish people are told to make the Mishkan, and they're told that the Mishkan does not override Shabbos. However, whereas originally the order was first Mishkan and then Shabbos, and that seems to be the default order, it was reversed. The first thing that we're told about in Parshas Vayakhel is Shabbos. The message is the same, but the order changed. Why? Well, we should note something else. I came across in the writings of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeschutz a fascinating insight. In the beginning of Vayakhel, Moshe introduces Vayakhel Moshe es kol hadas b'nei Yisrael vayom aleihem Eile hadvarim asher tziva Hashem la'asos osam. Eile hadvarim. These are the things. And what does he talk about? Shabbos. For how long? Two psukim. So the message that is comprised of all of two psukim is introduced with Eile hadvarim. But it doesn't sound like he said many things. He said two psukim. Especially if we contrast it with the next pasuk, Dalet vayomer Moshe al kol hadas b'nei Yisrael le'mor zeh hadavar. There's just one more thing. Oh, what is that one more thing? Well, the rest of Vayakhel. So the two psukim has Eile hadvarim, and the entire parsha gets Zeh hadavar. How can those two psukim be dvarim, and the rest of the parsha be one thing? Says Rabbi Yonasan Eibeschutz, it's true that there's less written about Shabbos, but the reason why it says Eile hadvarim is because if you look in the Mishnah in Maseches Chagiga and Daf Yud, you will see the following characterization of Shabbos, as if we didn't know anyway. Harorim hatluyim besara, mountains suspended from a hair. And what that means is, there is as much written in Torah Shebichtav relative to Torah Shebal Peh, as if you had one hair of Torah Shebichtav, from which hangs an entire mountain of Torah Shebal Peh. Shehein mikra muat v'halochos merubos. As we know, how much does the Torah write about Shabbos? Not too much, really. Don't do malacha, and a few other things. Hilchos Shabbos, with klalim and pratim, mountains suspended from hairs. And therefore, says Rabbi Yonasan Eibeschutz, there isn't really a lot of psukim here, but the Torah introduces with Eile HaDvarim the plurality, because there are two areas of Torah that you need in order to get Hilchos Shabbos. Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Eile HaDvarim. The Mishkan, by contrast, and it's a very stark contrast, many, many psukim, but I wonder if there's anything that we learn about the Mishkan from Torah Shebal Peh. There isn't anything left to learn in Torah Shebal Peh. It's all in Torah Shebichtav. It's written four or five times over. And therefore it's a lot. It's many psukim. But it's all one type of communication. Torah Shebichtav, Zeh HaDavar. The Torah itself is thus highlighted as it contrasts the presentation of Shabbos versus the Mishkan. Whereas the Mishkan is Zeh HaDavar, Torah Shebichtav only. Shabbos is Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. Va'api HaDvarim Ha'ele. Once we understand that the beginning of Parshas Vayakhel is in order to establish the rehabilitation of the Jewish people, and based on the Beis HaLevi, we understand that a critical part of that is that the section of the Torah that used to be written on the Luchos is no longer written anywhere other than the Jewish people. And that makes them Etzem HaKedusha. That is why the first thing Moshe Rabbeinu does is he reverses the order, so that the first thing to speak about, before speaking about anything else, is Shabbos. Because you can't walk, pardon the expression, four amos within Hilchos Shabbos without accessing a halacha of Torah Shebal Peh. And Moshe wishes to activate and to apply the attachment of the Jewish people to Torah Shebal Peh as soon as possible, because that's really what the beginning of Vayakhel is all about: recovery from the Egel, assuming their new status. And once they've been connected through Torah Shebal Peh with Hilchos Shabbos, they can then go on to discuss all of Melechus HaMishkan. And I believe that's a very worthy completion of the circle that began with the Beis HaLevi and Drushat Ches. Leave it over there.